little microphone yoga going on in the studio before the big show, moving things around, letting them stretch out, so forth. Good morning. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable. It is Thursday, the 6th of November, and we welcome you to the program. We thank you for being here. It means so much to us, and we have a great panel, so let me introduce them to you, and we'll get started right away. We also want to remind you of the thing that you can do and be a part of our program, which is write letters and send your thoughts. And we can't get to everything, but we certainly will try to get to as many as possible. And as I'm wont to say, we'll get the mood of the room, kind of get an idea of cross-section. A lot of letters are similar, and we try to get an idea of what's on people's minds as we meander our way through the morning. Another very busy news day, so we'll get right to it. We welcome to the program Ashley Didis, who is the Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner. And here's a fun little fact. She's actually upright and taking nourishment after Election
that
Day.
Is,
so that's
yeah.
good. That's good. Congratulations. How
Thank
did things
you.
Go?
Things went smoothly. My biggest problem on election night was running out of I voted stickers all throughout the day. We need more stickers. So I had people running out to all the poll sites with more I voted stickers. It was a good election day. It was a good early voting period. It's always a feat that we pull off. I sometimes feel like I'm the Santa Claus of elections. And now that we're a couple days removed, I did get a good night's sleep last night. So I'm happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. So thank you very, very much for all that you did during the elections and the whole team there and for election commissioners throughout our region of the hard work that they do to make sure that votes are actually counted and are go in the proper place. Let's put it that way. We also welcome to the program former vice president and editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, joins us. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. I had a glorious ride down. I mean, you think of November as kind of dreary, but man, the sky was blue. The landscape is still pretty nice.
Even on the muted leaves,
yeah.
when that sun shines on it, it just pops.
Yes,
and it's
beautiful.
Absolutely gorgeous. A very, very nice ride. Judy, always good to see you. Nick Rangel joins us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. And I will say the Albany I Voted stickers are wildly popular. We all love them. And I walked in and asked first, I was like, do I get a sticker? And the election worker was like, after you voted, ma'am, you know, I was like, all right, I'm voting, I promise.
But I've people, come this
they were,
far.
They were holding on to them like, no free stickers. That's really funny.
Ma'am.
But yeah, and I don't know, was it like a flag sticker that said I voted? Or
oh, no, Albany cool. has this new gorgeous. It's nipper with a butterfly for the pine bush butterflies and the egg
okay.
of Albany. And so it just has this really lovely like Albany story to it.
You started all this.
We did. So you can thank Ulster County for all of the great new I voted stickers all over the country. We inspired people to sort of move and expand away from the traditional flag with that serif font. And now we have contests. Ours involve kids drawing and submitting their designs. We make it fun. We have a contest. People can vote on it online. And it's taken off everywhere. So ours this year was the Statue of Liberty with a slice of pizza as her face. So drawn by a student in Saugerties, New York. I implore you to go to our website, voteulster.com, and watch the video of him receiving the Ulster County's Pride of Ulster Award. He gave a very uplifting and heartwarming speech. He got a standing ovation. There was not a dry eye in the house. A great kid, our artist this year.
You're tired, you're weak, you're pepperoni.
You're pepperoni.
We are thrilled to welcome back to our microphones March Gallagher. March is newly reelected just on Tuesday to the position of Ulster County Controller. She had to leave us for a while. Active candidates aren't allowed to participate on the show for all kinds of reasons, not made up by us, but made up by the FCC. And God knows, in this day and age, we don't want to piss them off. So we have Marge back. We are very, very happy. Former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley. Good morning, Marge. Congratulations on the win.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be back. I missed you guys, but I was watching and loving the station from afar with a phenomenal fun drive and also the terrific roundtables on the road, one of which was near me at Bard. And I wasn't able to be there, but I was so happy to hear it was happening. And I heard great things about it. And I also found as I was knocking on doors, people knew me from the roundtable. And that was a unique experience. I hadn't had that before in prior elections. They were like, wait, are you going back to the station? So my constituents are listening, and they're happy to have me back here. So I appreciate you guys inviting me back.
Well, we're thrilled to have you back on the program, and thank you very much for everything you've done. Just as we were hitting the airwaves and the news was going on, we got a breaking news alert, and that is that former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced that she is not seeking re-election, capping an historic career at 20 terms. 20 terms. Now, none of this is going to happen real soon, but she will not seek re-election next year, so she will certainly be until early 2027, would be my understanding. I have truly loved serving as your voice in Congress, said the California Democrat, who is 85. She said in a video dedicated to her San Francisco constituents, with a grateful heart, I look forward to my final year of service as your proud representative. Pelosi's departure will mark an end of an era in Congress. In 2007, she became the first woman elected to serve as Speaker of the House. For our daughters and granddaughters today, we have broken the marble ceiling, she said at the time. As Speaker and House Democratic leader, Pelosi was known for her shrewd political judgment, incisive skills as a legislative strategist. She was also a consistent political target for Republicans who cast her, a San Francisco multimillionaire, as the ultimate coastal elitist. Pelosi, who raised five children before coming to Congress, rejected that characterization. Pelosi was first elected in a special election in 1987. She famously claimed she went from the kitchen to the Congress after raising her kids and staying active in state politics. Fond of saying Congress has the power of the purse, she began her time in Capitol Hill as an appropriator, a role she drew from throughout her career. She quickly rose through Democratic leadership and became the first woman to lead a major party in either chamber when she was elected as the House Minority Leader in 2002. Judy.
You know, I was thinking about Nancy Pelosi coincidentally on my way down today, because last week when I was here, we had kind of an intense discussion about AOC, and it made me think that I should have more vigorously defended Nancy Pelosi when she was under attack all these years that it's happened, because she was a woman who effectively wielded power. And as a woman who was effectively wielding power, she came under attack in new and unusual and mean-spirited ways. I mean, she was shrewd. She was smart. She was a consummate politician. And I think the Democrats at the national level are going to be lost without her. I'm sure that they can always pick up the phone and call her. But she was just such a good politician. And I think that she was unjustly attacked, probably because she was a powerful Democrat, but in a heightened way because she was a woman.
There was also the I thought one of the key moments in the over the last few years was the what didn't seem to be a push out, which often is the case, where she said, okay, my time as in leadership is done, I'll go back to rank and file, and by the way, I will help Hakeem Jeffries in any way I possibly can along the way, which I think is more clean. Now, I don't know if it was as clean as it appeared, but I thought it's certainly more clean than it has been in past pushouts.
Right. A very effective way to manage a huge institution and to preserve the legacy that she created. I mean, she stood up to Donald Trump. She is strong. She knows how to pull the levers and be effective as a legislator and as a leader. She was I would argue that she's the best leader the House ever had.
Ashley.
I agree with you, Judy. I think that history is going to look back on Nancy Pelosi as one of the most effective and consequential speakers of the House of Representatives in the history of the chamber. I think that she has we are on a panel right now. I'm on a panel that is comprised of all women. We stand on the shoulders of those that come before us. And as a woman who navigates politics and all different flavors of constituents and voices, people like Nancy Pelosi have shown what leadership under pressure looks like. And I thank her for her service. I think she's recognizing that, you know, she will go out on a high note and people will give her flowers that she very much deserves. So we'll be sad to see her go. I think her leadership will be missed. But she has moved out of the way with what you just referenced, Joe, with the Hakeem change. And I think that, you know, the Democratic Party, we'll probably talk about this throughout the show, is sort of going through a change. And this is maybe a signal to other people in the Democratic Party who maybe need to make space for newer and younger voices.
Fill in the blank of who you're thinking about.
Yes.
Okay.
Fill in the blank.
March Gallagher.
When Nancy Pelosi stepped back and left the speakership, I had to reevaluate my own personal opinion of her because I realized that I think I was looking at her work through a sexist lens and I was judging her unfairly. And I realized if I had thought about her speakership as Mr. Pelosi, I would have thought she was an incredible speaker during the time of Trump. And it really made me rethink my own position and try to look at women leaders in a different light. I have to remove the gender to really have a clear frame of reference. And with her, I hadn't been doing that. But I also want to tell people that her book, The Art of Power, I read her book. It was riveting to me. I was disappointed that I got almost all the way to the end and then found out that she was from sort of a dynasty political family. Like, I didn't know that history, and she kind of hid it in the background. But it was a great book. And also, you know, her work on things like the Affordable Care Act, which was, in her words, really one of her proudest moments. You know, I didn't realize how important her role had been there. So I think she's a tremendous leader, and I think even her exit is going to be a model for others.
Nick?
Yeah. You know, we just learned about this a few minutes ago, but one of the things that came to mind was how vocal she was in opposition to the invasion of Iraq. And that was a moment for me in my, like, youth that was really pivotal in, like, where do I go in my political path and how do I engage politically as a young person? And I remember those conversations and those debates on both sides of the aisle and thinking, here's this female leader who's got all this opposition because she's female and she's powerful, who is, you know, really making a lot of sense about why we should not invade Iraq and we should not have this troop surge and these other pieces. And I think, like March said, we're going to spend probably the whole year reflecting on the many pivotal moments of Nancy Pelosi's career and the way that she guided Democrats and her party through really difficult times and really challenging conversations. She stood up very staunchly against many of George Bush's policies, but has also been very vocal against many of Donald Trump's policies. And I think I think we're going to have this really great opportunity to like spend time and simmer in them and be like, oh, yeah, reproductive rights. That is really important still. And again, and she's been doing that work for decades.
She has.
It's amazing.
And just as you were saying that, like the vision I have in my head is of her ripping up the State of the Union speech behind Donald Trump. Wow.
Perfect. Amazing. Political theater. Perfect. She nailed it.
I mean, I know she came under a lot of scrutiny and complaints over that, but I was like, man, all right, that's a statement. That is absolutely a statement.
Yeah, and let's not forget the personal to go back to the personal attacks. someone broke into her house
yes.
and attacked her husband with yes. a hammer. And, you know, very dangerous attack when she wasn't there. I'm sure that hit her hard. I mean, she's 85. I think it is time, you know, she realizes it's time for her to kind of enjoy probably all those grandchildren and great-grandchildren she has at this point. But the attack on her husband must have been just devastating.
I think also, and I've just been reading about this, so I think in a couple of books that are out, but the role that she played in encouraging Joe Biden to withdraw from the race as well, I think it may, I don't know, they only know of how damaging that was to their relationship. It was a very close relationship, but she was one who, again, said it's time and was trying to work that from the inside.
Her voice in the next presidential race on the Democratic side, I think, is going to carry a lot of weight. We'll see what she says. She could do something very interesting and throw her support not behind the expected Gavin Newsom because he's her governor, but someone else, and it could be, you know, really important.
We shall see. Again, the breaking news this morning that Nancy Pelosi has decided to retire and will not seek re-election. That announcement made this morning after 20 terms in the job and at 85 years old, has decided that this coming year will be her final year of service as the representative to her constituents in the San Francisco district that she has covered for so long. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Tuesday. No, Thursday morning. We're so much further along in the week than I give myself credit for.
Thank goodness.
I want to quickly share a quick letter. We began the program by talking about the I voted stickers. And Ashley was talking about the stickers, of course, in Ulster County. And I believe it was Nick who brought up how cool the stickers were in Albany. And the I voted sticker, which you absolutely described it to a T, but Nipper, a butterfly, and the egg,
yeah,
walked into a bar, and and it was we got a letter, and it was drawn and designed by a 9-year-old Annabelle Morton,
yes,
a fifth grader in Albany's in Albany schools. And and they sent us a picture of Ashley with the, did I get that right? No. What was her name?
Annabelle.
Of Annabelle with the stickers and backpack and the cool. I voted. How cool was that?
Nice. I saved
That's
my sticker.
Great. Yeah,
well, I didn't want to put it on because I wanted to save it.
We can get that online because it's a really cute picture. Again, Annabelle Morton was the fifth grader in Albany Schools who created the Albany I voted sticker. And I'm sure there's no coincidence, but the note we got was from a woman named Jen Morton.
Yeah, the moms.
No relation.
Yeah.
The moms are the biggest hype
yes,
man for these
that's
kids.
Good for them. Be proud. Real quick, a letter from Alice. While I agree with you that Nancy Pelosi is an extraordinary woman, leader, Democrat, speaker, etc., I have wondered how the Democrats have been so consistently inferior in their messaging and why. Is that not something she could have effectively impacted and improved? I hope she continues to live a good long life and help to keep our democracy alive and vibrant in the next few years and the 2026 election. Would anyone like to?
I'd like to jump in on that and just say there was an editorial in the Washington Post, an opinion piece by Matt Bai, saying, you know, Democrats can't agree on a message or who should deliver it, but they won anyway. And I think, you know, Nancy Pelosi wasn't in a position to be, quote, the leader of the party. And even sitting where she was as a former Speaker of the House. So, you know, we haven't been able to solidify on who is the leader of this party. So I don't blame Nancy Pelosi for that.
Also, Alice writes to us and says Pelosi's background is a good thing. I'm not very familiar with Pelosi's background, but I heard this before. I think that she had what could essentially be called mentorship and training from her family, which is not a bad thing at all. More women need this political mentorship, however they get it. She was lucky to have a family that didn't push her into the shadows. So
I agree with that. And what I would also say is she has a reputation for mentoring other women coming up through the ranks. And I think that's how you use your privilege and your power and your own opportunities. She maybe had a leg up because she came from a political family. Great. But then she used it to bring up people who did not come from political families and who did not have that same kind of privilege. And I think that is the leadership that we need to see among women and among people in positions of power across the board.
All right, let's move on to other topics. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I wonder why my screen did that. A question I ask often, I must say, but here we go. All right, we're back to normal. Let's go to the other stories. We'll talk a little bit more about the election, and that is how the vote shifted things and how we look at what occurred on Tuesday night. And as the sand started to settle yesterday and last night of people coming to terms with some of the races. And so let me just read from a Washington Post report how voters shifted in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York elections. Voters shifted sharply to the left across Virginia, New Jersey, New York City, sweeping into office Democrats who focused on affordability and capitalized on frustration with President Donald Trump. More than 2 million New York City voters, the most since 1969, turned out to elect a Democratic Socialist as mayor, rejecting a former governor who was once a standard bearer for the Democratic Party. 4 years ago, Republicans saw a wave of support that gave them the governorship in Virginia and kept the New Jersey race much closer than Democrats expected. While a moderate Democrat replaced a more liberal one in New York City Hall. This time, the energy in all three places shifted distinctly toward Democrats and the left of the party. In every county and independent city in Virginia, Democrat Abigail Spanberger racked up more of the vote than Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat who lost to Republican Glenn Youngkin in the 2021 race for governor. She outperformed him across those counties by a median of 13 percentage points, according to an analysis by the Washington Post. Also, when in looking at New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill won by a much wider margin than Governor Phil Murphy did when he narrowly secured a second term 4 years ago. Both faced Republican Jack Cittarelli, but Sherrill won more comfortably by securing support across much of the state. And we certainly talked about this at great length, but I'll just mention it, which is in New York City, Zohran Mamdani, a 34-year-old Democratic Socialist and member of the State Assembly, beat former Governor Andrew Cuomo by a larger margin Tuesday than he did 5 months ago in the Democratic primary. Mamdani expanded on his earlier coalition of younger, college-educated, and liberal voters in Manhattan and nearby gentrifying neighborhoods. He performed better in precincts with fewer voters over the age of 60. Younger precincts also saw higher turnout this election compared with 2021. If only we had a Board of Elections commissioner to begin and give us a little thought on,
sure,
on this.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, as the turnout was coming in live from my poll sites, I was looking at, all we can look at is the enrollments of the voters, and I saw a depression among your really mostly historically reliable Republican base voters by a factor in some of my municipalities from either from 2 to 6 points. They were just not voting. And typically election day is the day that we see those voters come out. Knowing that that was sort of where the landscape was falling, it was not as shocking as maybe, you know, those that don't have access to that information all day long on election night when in Ulster County we flipped towns that have never seen a Democratic supervisor in modern times. And they won with not just small margins, but some of them were very decisive. The message of these bigger campaigns, particularly Mondami's, since we in Ulster are in the New York City media market, very much are landing, hammering every interview I ever saw him give, hammering back on affordability. When they tried to lay traps for him in the media, for him to comment about his Democratic Socialist background, he brought it back to affordability. And that is why we saw this huge turnout, which is why over million people came out to vote, because this is something that I think Democrats going into next year really need to embrace this message. The economy is not working for most people. We are seeing right now with the government shutdown and SNAP benefits that have expired. I am seeing it in my own community in the food pantry. I did a meeting across the street the other day from People's Place, which is one of our main food pantries in Kingston. The lines around the block. People are This should not happen in the richest country in the world, and it is. While Donald Trump is having a Great Gatsby-themed party the night that SNAP benefits are shutting off, and the White House is being remodeled without any oversight, and Speaker Johnson won't bring anyone back for conversations, this is what Americans are seeing. So it's not this magical pill that Democrats have given to everybody. We can observe it, and that's why you're seeing blocks of voters who voted last year on an affordability message for Donald Trump, Latinos, men, are swinging back to candidates who are talking about it and not running away with their money and having huge parties with it. So that's what I think the Democrats saw and will continue to bring that message next year.
Mark?
My question is, you know, is it a Democratic Socialist message? Is it a moderate Democratic message? You know, Spanberger and Sherrill really with their national security credentials and more of a moderate take. And I think it's really just an anti-Trump message. I think Democrats are honed in on speaking about the negatives that the Trump administration and his followers are bringing in terms of policy. It's very obvious. I agree with Ashley that the SNAP benefits cliff has been a huge impact. And also, I think while the Republicans tried to blame the Democrats for the shutdown, people went on to their exchanges nationally to look at their health insurance rates, and we saw like unbelievable skyrocketing of premiums, not just for Affordable Care Act, but also some private held insurance through employers, and that has really impacted people. People realize, oh, it's not just Chuck Schumer wanting a shutdown to be a stick in the mud, which is kind of the way the Republicans were trying to make it sound, but that there is a real issue here, and that regular Americans really will not be able to afford health insurance. I saw dozens of people saying they were just going to drop their insurance, put their money in the bank, and pray that they don't have a health scare. And I think that's what's driving the turnout here in record numbers. These bread and butter issues, can you put food on the table? Can you go to the doctor? And if the answer to those two questions is no, you're definitely going to go to the party that's not in power at the time. So I think that that's it's not so much one central message by the Democrats. It's more running away from this terrible policy bag that the Republicans have brought with Trump and MAGA.
Nick.
Yeah, I think all those things are true. What I also think is true is that the Republican Party had, at the early parts of the shutdown, successfully placed the blame squarely on the Democrats. But in the last few weeks, in addition to seeing the fallout of a long-term shutdown, they're also learning that behind the scenes, actually, the House has been not at the Capitol. They haven't been at the Capitol for weeks. And when the members are not at the Capitol, they are not negotiating the actual language of the bills. We know that they could not get agreement on the minibus, which is three of the 12 budget bills, that the three budget bills that they think that they or originally thought they could pass together, blew up their own budget goals, and they have not been able to make any movement on that in months. And that Speaker Johnson has told everyone that they shouldn't come home until January or come back to the Capitol until January, which flags for people that there is not an end in sight that's today or tomorrow or the next day. Even if Democrats passed the continuing resolution that the House passed, it expires next week. So there is a real like acknowledgement and a real shift in perspective that this is actually squarely a Republican-driven chaos causing shutdown that is impacting people's day-to-day lives right now.
Which I thought was interesting in the president's initial remarks, and he continued them yesterday in his press availabilities by blaming the shutdown. And I thought that was interesting because I agree with you. I think that the tide is turning on that, and people looking at the Republicans and saying, okay, but what are you all doing about it? You're in the presidency, you're in the House, you're in the Senate. What are you doing about it? And then you have the president blaming that as the reason. And it's a message that didn't seem to resonate with voters before Election Day, and I don't know how it's resonating, but I wouldn't imagine as strongly. Judy?
You know, he's so darn predictable, isn't he? Oh, it wasn't my fault. Trump wasn't on the ballot. You know, I almost had to feel sorry for him in that respect. But, you know, Steve...
Almost.
Almost.
You know,
Steve Bannon made the really interesting point that about these two races in Georgia, statewide races for, I think, utility commission, and Democrats won that. And he, you know, Steve Bannon, he's pretty astute when it comes to political observations. He's worried for Republicans. The other thing I wanted to note was that we always, in the news business, we always talk about ways of presenting information in different ways that will reach our audience. And these maps and charts that Washington Post created clearly showed the shift. You saw that they had one of these arrow charts.
Little arrows plus five.
And it, you know, and I used to like roll my eyes at them, but these were so devastatingly accurate, and that clearly showed what was happening both in, you know, Virginia and New Jersey. The shift, you know, the whole state kind of shifted into Ohio, and so that is it's important for us to continue to present this kind of information in new ways that reaches voters, and so they understand what's happening. I think J.D. Vance was blaming it all on, you know, these are blue places that always will vote blue. No big deal. Let's move on. We're not. There's no danger here. But the deep dive into, you know, the exit polling and to see what really happened, you can see that there was the people who voted for Trump last time met a far greater number of them voted Democratic this time. And guess what? Despite what Steve Bannon says, Donald Trump is not going to be on a ballot anytime soon, unless it's one of his children. So, you know, I'd be interested to see what the voter turnout is in aggregate as opposed to 4 years ago. If we know that Democrats turned out, Republicans did not, but was the aggregate number higher or lower?
We have to go to a break. I just would like to say that to what you were referring to in J.D. Vance and what he said, but Mike Johnson, to me, won the award for cluelessness? I don't know. What happened last night, he said, was blue states and blue cities voting blue. There were no surprises whatsoever, he said at a Wednesday press briefing. We all saw that coming, and no one should read anything into last night's election results. Off-year elections are not indicative of what's to come. That's what history teaches us. And the loss was didn't think the loss was any reflection about Republicans whatsoever. That from Mike Johnson.
I hope he keeps thinking that.
Yeah.
And behaving as if that is the truth.
As such.
Yeah.
We'll take a break and return. More show to come up, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we welcome your letters as always. We have a few more letters to go, and We'll take a break at the top of the hour as well, and then when we come back, we'll finish up, talk more about the political stuff, the election and fallout and so forth. We begin with Jay, who says, amen, bring the House back. The president shouldn't be allowed to leave the country until the government is open. We need to negotiate on all sides. Then, Sally, the Democrats need to find a leader and not at the last minute. All right. But who would that be?
I mean, I think he's referring, she's referring to Kamala Harris, like a last minute ditch to win that presidency.
I understand the point.
And there's been fairly substantial disappointment with Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries so far. Have they taken the opposition to the level it needs to be at to counter what the Republicans are doing? A dynamic kind of smart person. I mean, maybe they're playing the shutdown well. I mean, if the election hadn't gone the way that it did, they would be in a pretty bad position. I heard Mark Whitman the other day saying, well, what's the exit strategy? I think their exit strategy is to get the Affordable Care subsidies restored.
I don't know who the leader is. I mean, we have a bunch of leaders with powerful voices speaking right now, including, you know, Newsom, Pritzker. I find every time he speaks, I'm like, yes, that guy, what he said. Yes, yes, yes. So I think we have to look outside of Washington at some of our gubernatorial leadership, and then also at, you know, people like AOC and Mamdani who are speaking to younger voters and carrying a powerful message. So we haven't solidified around a single leader yet, and I think that's going to be to our benefit. I don't think we want to see a last-minute Democratic selection of a leader, but I think having multiple voices at the table is going to hone the message and make a bit broader tent.
Yeah, I agree with that, March. I think that right now, going into a midterm election, you're going to have members of Congress running in very competitive districts, and they have to tailor the message to their district. You saw that with the election on Tuesday. Mikey Sherrill and Zohran Mamdani, they share a border with their state and their city, but they are very different, but they all hone back to the same message. Making lives easier for regular people. That can be a lot of voices, especially when we're up against an authoritarian leader in Donald Trump. It's okay to have a lot of people right now. It's a bench building cycle. And that's how I think that that's a good thing to have a lot of voices and not just one person for all of the, you know, amalgamous Democratic Party. It's always been a big tent. And I think that's going to work to our strength. That's a good thing.
Big tent, not a big cult.
Yeah.
I do think there's – so one of the reflections I had on Kamala Harris's campaign was she did two things that I think turned a lot of voters off. One is she courted too many high-profile Republicans with a lot of baggage, right? And second, while the Democrats talk about affordability, they don't often message the solutions in a way that is both specific and particularized for a large enough group of people. I loved Harris's housing platform, but there were 30 ways that she was going to encourage first-time homebuyers. And most people looked at the first-time homebuyer $25,000 down payment as like unreachable to them and not enough to be swaying their vote and too complicated to be the thing that like hinged their support. And one of what I think Zohran Mamdani's successes were was specific and particularized affordability plan. Mm-hmm. And I think if the Democratic Party learns from those two lessons, stop courting far right conservatives with lots of baggage, and also find particularized affordability agendas and initiatives that are easy to understand and impact a broad number of people without confusing somebody about how to achieve or access that benefit. Universal child care, easy, specific, impacts almost everybody, right? Like that
right.
It's an easy thing to hinge on, not first-time home buyer credits. Like that is too complicated.
Hindsight, of course, being 2020. Judy, I remember you and I talking about this, and the reason I remember is because we were in agreement, and that was that at the time when just after the announcement was made that Kamala Harris was going to run, and at that point, we were waiting for her to do an interview. We were waiting for her to do a press conference. We were waiting for her to talk and to have a message. And she didn't do it. And then there was that really ham-handed event where they did it in the diner, where it was her and the vice presidential candidate, and they're talking. And it just meandered, and it didn't have a message, and it seemed sort of...
Flat.
I was going to say a little dodgy, maybe. But I was reminded of that on Tuesday night when Hakeem Jeffries was on CNN. And you've just had a win. You've had a win. This is a win. Talk about the win. Don't talk about Epstein. Don't talk about, you know, they won't invite us to the party. Don't scream and yell. Talk about what you're doing right. And I was just shocked that they didn't have the fortitude to be able to, or he at least, to put those messages across at a time where it's like served to you on a platter. You just did really well in the election. Brag about it a little bit.
Right. He does. The problem is that they don't. Politicians who do that don't come across as authentic, and I think that's one of the things the voters are craving. They speak in pre-written, you know, platitudes, and voters have to question: do they really know what they're talking about? Can they go off script? Is the thing.
So Polly has the answer. She says Schumer and Jeffries speak like they're talking only to politicians. Mamdani spoke in the language of everyday people. We'll take a break. We'll be back. We have much more to discuss. We will do all of that right after this break and news with David Gustina. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've been having a delightful conversation, and we're glad that if you've been with us since the beginning, thank you very much. If you're just joining us, well, welcome aboard. Ashley Diddes is here, Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner. March Gallagher is back. We're thrilled. Ulster County Controller and former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley. March was away for a bit, running for re-election. She won. Now she's back, and we are very, very happy to have her in Studio A. Judy Patrick joins us, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor at the Daily Gazette, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Thank you all for being with us. Just a couple of errant letters, and then we will move on to some other topics. Joseph writes, face of Democratic Party, pay attention to Andy Beshear's second term governor of Kentucky, a very red state. Let's get rid of the myth that Trump is a good negotiator. A good negotiator gets what they want, or most of what they want, without making the other party feel humiliated, resentful, angry, and thinking about revenge. I think that's a stylistic choice.
Was Trump ever a good negotiator? Then I have to look at that and
yes.
say, hmm.
Russ says, though the off-year election heralded Democratic success, it had no impact on our national representation in the House. By November of 2026, though, the tariffs will have been judicially removed. The tariff monies will have been refunded, and our economy will again be booming. This bodes well for the Republicans. Well, this will be the next item that we talk about as far as the Supreme Court about tariffs. And I don't know. I think what Russ writes about is still open to see what happens there.
Does that mean I'm going to get the $10 in tariffs back that I paid for my daffodils from the Netherlands this year?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Absolutely. You can buy more daffodils. Schumer And Jeffrey's, I read that letter. I read that letter. My apologies. And I think we are we up to date? We are up to date. Okay. Let's go to other stories that are making news. And that has to do with the skepticism over tariffs that appeared to be the case in the Supreme Court, although it did shift as time went on. The Supreme Court appeared skeptical Wednesday that President Donald Trump has legal authority to impose tariffs on a vast range of goods from nearly all countries, signaling the justices could strike down or sharply limit the administration's signature economic policy. This from the Washington Post. Liberal justices were expected to be critical of Trump's tariffs, but several of the court's conservatives joined them in sharply questioning an attorney for the Trump administration during more than 2.5 hours of arguments. Justice Neil Gorsuch, for example, wondered aloud about the implications of granting the president tariff authority with few bounds. The Constitution assigns Congress the power to levy taxes, he noted, appearing wary of such a dramatic expansion of the power of the chief executive. If Congress can hand off its tariff power to the president, what would prohibit Congress from just abdicating all responsibility to regulate foreign commerce or, for that matter, declare war to the president? Where's he been? Okay, Gorsuch, sorry. I apologize for the commentary. Gorsuch asked Solicitor General John Sauer, who argued for the administration. Congress decides tomorrow, well, we're tired of this legislative business. We're just going to hand it off to the president. What would stop Congress from doing that? Sauer said that Congress could not go that far. That would really be an abdication, not a delegation of power, he said. Gorsuch appeared unconvinced.
You know, I listened to an hour or so of this yesterday. I was driving, and I just love listening to lawyers argue because it's so fascinating. They're smart, and, you know, you can understand the points they're coming from and as things evolve. That being said, you know, this is all about Donald Trump wanting more power. If he really wanted these tariffs, he could just go to Congress, which he controls, and they would do what he wanted to do. But instead, he's making this stand that he wants this power to do tariffs for whatever reason he wants. Apparently, the Supreme Court didn't get into the reasons whether or not there was a justifiable emergency. It was all about whether or not the law actually allowed him to do this broad imposition of tariffs at will, and whether or not that was taking away a really clearly defined power that they gave to Congress. Again, Congress has abdicated all power, essentially, to this president. They do what he wants, when he wants. Why didn't he just ask them to do the tariffs he wanted? Because he wants the flexibility to do it, to take it away at a moment's notice. It's interesting.
Nick?
Yeah, I would argue, actually, he does not have that much power in Congress, especially if the House is on recess for months at a time. They have passed hardly any bills this year, and they certainly can't get two House bills. They can't do it at the speed at which that the president wants to exert that power. He wants to see big reforms at a speed that doesn't exist in government, just between having to draft and redraft and pass and repass. And also, you have to be at work to do it. So I think he does not actually have that much power. I think he also does not have that much, I don't know that Congress has expressed that much respect for his opinions in actual governance and governance questions. And I think that shows up in the fact he's unable to get policy change, and also that the majority of his own party often fail to advance his policy agenda in their own language or in their own states.
I was blown away by the argument that these are not revenue tariffs. They're regulatory tariffs. That's what the administration attorneys are arguing. These are regulatory tariffs. They're about policy. They're about sending a message to these other governments. It's not about raising revenues. Yet at the same time, it's already raised $88 billion. You know, according to Yale Budget Lab, that's $2,400 per family. Other estimates, $1,300 per family this year. and tariffs are higher than they've been any time since the Great Depression, but they're saying it's a regulatory issue, it's not a revenue issue. I thought it was very interesting to hear the discussions about the major questions doctrine. You know, this has been used to knock down things like student loan forgiveness under Biden, things like coronavirus vaccination, climate change initiatives, and now we're seeing the justices say, like, hey, wait a minute, maybe this also applies here to tariffs. And just to refresh for people listening, you know, the major questions doctrine is really if the executive branch claims authority under a statute to carry out a policy with a major economic or political consequences, the statute must be explicit in that authority. So I hope that the Supreme Court will be a check and balance here. You know, Trump said in capital letters, this is life or death for our country. And I think he's really talking about himself here. You know, he knows that if he loses this, there actually is some backstop in Washington that none of us really thought was there.
Well, also the impact of the loss of that revenue, those actual taxes on Americans would really obliterate their entire budget agenda and initiative, right?
And Amy Coney Barrett said, you know, I think rightfully so, like, how would we return this money? This would be a mess. And Judy, I hadn't even thought until you talked about, would I get my $10 back? I hadn't even thought, like, oh, it's the American people who are owed this money. I wasn't thinking like that. I don't know how you would refund these tariffs. It seems like a nightmare.
I think you could cancel the tariffs going forward without technically refunding the dollars, or you could use the dollars in a funding plan through an appropriations process, and that might be sort of a settlement with SCOTUS or through SCOTUS, like sort of an agreement.
I mean,
about
have
how to
negotiate
do
some sort of payback. I can't see that happening. I don't know. I'm really curious to see where they come down on this decision. And I think we'll know in short order, right? They're not going to wait till June. We're
right,
going to
yeah.
know in the next month or two.
Right.
And it should be consequential.
You know, people have been so many people have been disillusioned with the Supreme Court and thinking that anytime anything gets to the Supreme Court about Donald Trump, that they're going to rule in favor of Donald Trump. And I think Donald Trump thinks the same way. and so the fact that this may not go his way, I think it has people's hopes up that maybe they do have a spine, that there is a limit to what they will do. Or maybe they've decided that, you know, we have to reestablish our reputation. We have to give the people a decision once in a while that goes against Donald Trump. I don't know what they're doing.
Or they're just posturing. They're making it look like they have a backbone and that they're doing hard thinking. And at the end of the day, they're going to come down to the argument and say, well, if the president has the ability to ban trading with a country altogether, why wouldn't he have the ability to raise tariffs? And that was one of the arguments that was made. Like, he does have this exceptional power on the international relations stage for the American people. So I'm a little bit nervous about resting on my laurels and taking comfort in the arguments until I see the actual opinion. Yeah.
I think they will explore or are exploring to the distinguishing factors between which countries are having tariffs leveraged against them, where there's an argument that we're using tariffs for these countries because they pose a specific risk, but he's also using these tariffs in, like, our European partners in a really dramatic way. And I think there could be maybe some lines drawn around maybe he does have the power, but only in these spaces. But I think they're also having a real problem with their own self-identity around textualism and finding, you know, the word for tariff or tax in the legislation and saying, you know, if Congress meant for you to have this power, they would have said so.
And they still could step up, as I said, and enact a tariff. You've got to wonder what they must be planning, what their fallback is going to be if the Supreme Court rules against the administration. And I just can't believe that they won't just, you know, they won't just give up and end the tariffs. They're going to do something. And keep in mind that there are a lot of industries that are really being affected by this, a lot of small businesses being affected. And the price of my coffee every day has shot up. Is shot through the roof. I mean, there are things that the everyday Americans know come from a different country, avocados, bananas, and those prices are up. And maybe it's not because maybe there's some sort of pest or disease affecting the coffee or the orange juice, All I know is I'm paying like a dollar more.
I've asked the auditors to pull every invoice that has a tariff charge on it. I want to see, I want to start aggregating that and see what they look like. Yeah. For the county, Ulster County. Yeah.
Do you have any sense early?
No, I don't. I just made that request last week, so I don't really have a good sense. You know, one invoice popped up where it was, you know, it said basically, sorry, our prices are higher. It's because of tariffs. But I do think there are invoices out there that actually have a tariff charge, and I want to see them. Yeah.
Well, the I mean, there's the ancillary increase in prices if an industry knows that this one brand is increasing in tariff, everybody else will raise their prices to benefit from the overall increase in prices. We saw that during the pandemic, right? So even if you were clever and could say, well, there's one farm in California that has, you know, pomegranates, but overall pomegranates are going to go up in cost. And I think that's an unfortunate result of capitalism.
We're feeling it.
Let's go to just somewhat on going back to the election for a moment. But we touched on the fringes of this, but I don't think we went right in of Republicans pointing fingers after their losses. But the second part of this in the New York Times story that came out last night was there's a lot of finger pointing, but none of it's going toward Trump. And I think that obviously that's I don't think that's very surprising, but I do think it's interesting. And I also don't know how much of maybe there would be private finger pointing. I don't know. I did read the remarks of the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and earlier about how this meant nothing at all, what happened on Election Day. And although Speaker Johnson said that the mayor-elect of New York City was used the news conference to cast him as the new leader of the Democratic Party, and that this he was going to be the face of the party in the days and months to come. In emails and group chats, Republican officials slammed their nominee for governor in Virginia as a fatally flawed candidate and chided their donors for not opening their wallets wide enough. And on Fox News, other Republicans argued the Democrats had prolonged the government shutdown for their own advantage. And then, stop me if you've heard this one, but another reason all this happened on Tuesday was election interference.
Oh, really?
An oldie but a goodie.
You know, Trump was pretty lethargic on this on these races, too. He didn't go out and do any rallies for candidates.
Tele Zoom things.
Yeah, make a call. He didn't do any of that. It's like almost like he gave up. He doesn't care. He's, you know, but he needs to care about the midterm elections. Maybe he was just too busy, again, having a party, traveling the world. But it seems like he is the head of the party. He should have done a little bit more to raise some money for these people. And so they should be complaining to him about what he did. I think he knows the polls. He saw what was happening and he didn't step in.
I'm not convinced he cares about the rest of the Republican Party very much. And I think he probably believes that he might be president again. And I think he probably believes that SCOTUS will give him enough power that it won't matter so much that there's a blue wave in Congress, because he'll still be able to send ICE agents into Chicago and arrest, round up people in Home Depot parking lots. Like, that nobody is stopping him from doing that. And I'm not sure he is particularly fearful of losing the majority in Congress.
I saw an interesting analysis that was saying, you know, one of the reasons Republicans haven't blamed Trump, it creates public flogging and depresses turnout. On the other hand, if they defend Trump, then they know they energize the Dems and independents to, you know, rally against. So they're sort of hamstrung. By the way, that's not the case in our county. Look at our daily paper, the Daily Freeman. And the headline is Ulster County political leaders blame Trump for losses.
Yeah,
and they are really, you know, we're a very blue county and a, you know, in a blue state. And so that may be why, but they are blaming Trump locally.
This from the New York Times article, Democratic voters, as they have done in nearly every election since Mr. Trump first took office, surged to the polls to express their discontent with his handling of the presidency. That has been the case since 2016. And Republicans again struggled to turn out their MAGA base without the president's name on the ballot, which I do think is an interesting conundrum for the party.
One of the messages I'm starting to hear from Republicans is, if you don't turn out in the midterms, we are only giving Donald Trump a 2-year presidency. He's going to, the second half of his presidency will be lost. And I think you'll start to hear that message more and more, that we need to rally around him if we want him to achieve the agenda that he set forth. I think one of the reasons he's done things so quickly is maybe he does think he's only got 2 years. He wants to build that new ballroom so at least he gets to host a couple of events in this first 2 years before if the Democrats take back the House. I mean, they're going to make things happen in a way that Donald Trump is not going to like.
So here's a little bon mot. Mm-hmm. They say that I wasn't on the ballot and was the biggest factor, he told reporters at a Wednesday breakfast with the Republican leaders. I don't know about that, but I was honored that they said it.
They know what he likes. And a lot of them, you know, they have seen before if they go against him, it's not too late to be in a primary before next year's elections. Some of these, they've gerrymandered the maps, and that party is Donald Trump. That is very clear. And he was on the ballot. His policies are what is being reflected in people voting. The tariffs are making everything more expensive. People are feeling that. His presence is constant, and that is why you've seen rallies across the country, and that was reflected in not just Republicans, their depressed turnout, but in enthusiasm among Democrats and particularly independent voters. The ICE policies, snatching people off the streets, school teachers. I've got a friend who lives in Chicago. At her daycare, one of their teachers was snatched up right in front of her kid and the whole class. This is not a popular policy. People are seeing that. You saw Hispanic voters coming back to the Democratic Party. There's talk about this is obviously something that's hitting their communities, and they might be reflecting that in their vote. The Republican Party, if they want to survive post-Trump, they have to really start to look at themselves, much as the Democrats have, about what's their message going to be in a post-Trump world. Yeah, he's talking about running again, but they've also sort of backtracked on that. Like, that's a even Mike Johnson, as much as he will simp for Trump all day, he has said that is a very heavy lift. So I think that we just have to keep the heat on him. And I think they're feeling it. So that's good.
I do just want to, I mean, most of the GOP voters who voted for Trump still support the ICE activity. Most of Trump's GOP voters do support the tariffs and do not recognize them as a tax. So, like, it is true that marginal independent voters may be coming back to the Democratic Party, and Democrats who just didn't vote for Harris came out to vote this week because Trump's policies were never in favor with those voters. It is not true that Trump's own GOP voters are fleeing because of ICE or tariffs or any of the things that we've talked about here as being particularly outrageous.
Well, I also, and
which is fascinating.
Yeah,
I mean, I only say that
because there's
like
a ceiling on that, and they have to start expanding it among their rabid base. Like, that's how they lost before, and that's how they'll lose again.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll continue the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Always nice to have you with us. And we have a great group this morning, and we are talking about politics and elections and Supreme Courts and all that stuff. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Couple of letters before we move on fully. Allen says the fact that they signed off on eliminating the Fourth Amendment, allowing ICE to stop people simply for being brown, gives me zero faith in the current Supreme Court of the United States to do anything meaningful. That from Allen. Amy writes, Trump isn't having a worried reaction to the recent elections because he figures he'll be king before the midterms, if we even get to have midterm elections, that is. That is from Amy. Chris, it's not the Supreme Court's job to worry about the fallout of illegal actions, and it is certainly not something that should be considered. This would not be considered if you or I broke the law. Also, whatever happened to those tariff checks promised to every American? Where is the money going, and who is responsible for its management? Then we go to this letter from Kathy. This is all about Judy's question on getting her $10 back on daffodils. Kathy, how to refund tariffs to taxpayers? That's easy. Send them a check. We just got ours from our governor. All right. Let's see. I think finally, are the Canadians that much better educated? How is it possible the Canadians came up with an ad that destroyed Trump's tariffs so effectively with President Reagan's words, and the Dems couldn't do anything close? That's not a bad observation, I think. All right.
And then they apologized for the ad.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, we hurt your feelings.
Yes.
Or maybe it was a sorry your feelings were hurt kind of apology.
Well, yeah. And that's a Canadian thing, right?
No comment.
I mean, like a lovely Canadian thing, but a Canadian thing. All right, let's go back to the other topics on the docket for this Thursday. It's 37 minutes past 10 o'clock. On the sixth day of November. And we go to the issue of airports shut down, flights, FAA, air traffic controllers. I know one does not perhaps have anything to do with the other, but as we're having this discussion, we can't just constantly see this video of a plane exploding as it's going into Louisville. So the Trump administration says the move, which is ordering the FAA to cut 10% in flights at several airports, will affect some 40 markets, part of an effort to ease pressure on air traffic controllers. Some of the nation's busiest airports, including those serving Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, and D.C., could be among the ones that will offer fewer flights beginning Friday, otherwise known as tomorrow, according to a person briefed on the process who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal plans. However, the person cautioned the list is preliminary and could change as discussions continue. The flight reductions were announced Thursday as part of a Trump administration effort aimed at easing pressure on air traffic controllers and other frontline aviation personnel working without pay as the government shutdown, the longest in history, enters its second month. The current list of airports, most of the ones you would expect, Albany isn't on it, but Anchorage is ones that I think probably would directly affect us. Boston, Baltimore, Charlotte, Dallas, Reagan, Denver, Dallas-Fort Worth, Fort Lauderdale.
JFK is on there. LaGuardia is on there.
JFK and LaGuardia, correct.
But not Newark, strangely.
Orlando, Chicago, Chicago O'Hare and Chicago Midway, as well as Philadelphia International Airport. So I won't read all 40, but you get the idea that these are, it's a
hubs.
Have fun. Yeah. especially coming from, if you fly out of Albany, and I there's nothing more I love out of Albany, but there are not many direct flights. They are unless you're going to Baltimore, but as far as usually, if you're going from one place to the other, there is a stop, and so that brings you into another airport system. So, I'm not aware in my 35-year history in aviation where we've had a situation where we're taking these kinds of measures, according to FAA head Brian Bedford at a news conference on Wednesday. Then again, we're in new territory in terms of government shutdowns. A 10% cut at a major hub like Chicago O'Hare, for example, could mean 121 fewer flights or more than 14,500 fewer seats a day, according to an estimate by an aviation analytics data firm, Cirium. There will be frustration, said Sean Duffy.
Understatement of 2025.
But in the end, our sole role is to make sure that we keep the airspace as safe as possible. I'm good with that. I'm good with keeping the air safe, the airspace safe.
Well, they say it's data-driven, and Democrats are starting to ask, okay, then share the data. What is the risk assessment behind this? You know, I think that this is just one big happy Thanksgiving. Either your family is too broke to really afford Thanksgiving and isn't going to get SNAP, or if you're middle class and you're flying anyone anywhere in the country, we're going to make that a nightmare too. So I think that it's really just a vengeful tactic. I was stunned to see that there's such a vacancy rate in the ranks of air traffic controllers. 3,000 vacancies among 14,000 positions. That's a 21.4% vacancy rate. I mean, like, I think about my operation and what we would do if we didn't have that. You know, these air traffic controllers are all working overtime to make up the difference, and now you have them going two paychecks without. I was reading some of them are working second jobs like Uber to make up the difference. And, you know, this is just ridiculous. This is not a way to govern. This is a critical infrastructure, super important responsibility of the federal government. And Trump is using revenge, I feel like, to target here when he could be paying them with tariffs. We were talking about, where is the tariff money going? Well, we did fund WIC with tariff money because he knew that was going to look bad. Well, fund air traffic controllers. You know, let's get something done here. So I think it's a big, happy, unhappy Thanksgiving present from Trump.
Do you think we picked a bad year to go to Hawaii for Christmas?
No. Every year is a good year to go to Hawaii, Joe.
Okay.
When I first heard this, I really wanted the data. I wanted to know, what exactly are they trying to do? And it seems like they're just trying to turn the screws just a little bit, and they have no compassion for anyone who's ever flown commercial, because it is tough. I mean, has Donald Trump ever flown commercial? This is just, and it's like a war on Thanksgiving, a war on Christmas. We're going to get, you know, tariffs on our imported Christmas trees from Canada. Look at the calendar. It's 3 weeks away. It's the busiest travel day of the year. People have vacations planned that are non-refundable. I already heard of there were cancellations in Orlando last week or the week before, and I heard of a family that got in their car from upstate New York and drove, the 12 to 18 hours to Disney, because those were non-refundable, and they had planned this for years.
That's what we're going to do to Hawaii. it's true, and it seems to be very Doge-like in the sense of it's about the numbers and maybe less about the common sense of figuring out what goes where and how.
Yeah, I mean, if the political intent is to bring the argument back that this is the Democrats' fault, pardon the pun, I don't think this is going to land well, because they're the ones that are doing it and they're the ones that are in charge. The last government shutdown that ended, the 2018 into 2019, ended because of air traffic controllers not going to work. It wasn't a large group of people, but that's what got everybody back to the table. So Sean Duffy, I can't look at him with, I'm a child of the 90s, I can't look at him without remembering that he was on reality TV back in the day, so it's hard for me to take him seriously. But this is, I think this is a miscalculation. This is going to just make people even that much more upset at the Trump administration for making their lives harder.
I mean, I don't think it's a political ploy. I think they're doing it because they actually think they have to, because they know the shutdown is projected to last until January. And even in the case of WIC, that was a short term. It's likely not even a legal use of those tariffs. There is not an appropriation bill that funds WIC right now. All of the appropriations expire, run out by the end of the year. So my program, my legal services corporations, all of the, you know, the HUD, housing vouchers and Section 8, HEAP benefits, all of those are actually ending. They're truly actually ending. And I think in this case, the air traffic controllers are a resource that are coming to the end of its line, and they are worried about the safety of people during holiday travel. There have been airplanes that ran into each other. There are airports that close on no notice because nobody showed up to work that day. Newark was closed last week, right?
Yeah.
And at random, I mean, there's no even way to know that that the controllers aren't coming to work because they all got picked up their Uber shifts. Like, I think this move actually scares the GOP. I think they are acting in a conservative way, not like little C conservative, in a preservation way, because they are going to get blamed for crashes that happen on the tarmac because there aren't controllers out there.
No, I think
which we're already seeing.
I agree with you. Also, when you hear the unions, in regards to aviation, from the pilots and the workers on the planes and so forth, of them expressing their great concerns and saying this is not sustainable, we can't keep doing this, or things are already really dangerous, and if we keep doing it, it's going to be even more so.
Right. And all those airline companies, these, you know, billion-dollar industries, are going to experience the economic impact of fatal crashes, of flights not being able to leave or arrive or handle their lines safely, or having to be redirected to other airports. I think this is actually probably a smart move, given the fact that the shutdown is nowhere near ending.
I think that this may be the straw that breaks the camel's back on the shutdown. And it's sad, from my perspective, that elimination of food stamps didn't do
it.
Yeah,
you would think starving children would do it, but no.
If I can't go to Disney,
I can't get to Orlando.
Duffy also said that mass chaos will occur if the shutdown goes on, and he said, we, quote, may close parts of national airspace. I thought that was very profound and scary. What does that actually mean? You know, what would that look like? And also, I saw that 80% of air traffic controllers were absent last Friday from New York's busiest hub. What? Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear 80% of air traffic controllers are absent.
And so, how incredible that the United States of America can't keep its airports open. Like, that should send shockwaves through everybody.
Well, and I was reading an article two nights ago, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote it or quote it even probably accurately, but I'm going to give it a shot, which was another point that this article was making, is that we've seen increased times at airports where there have been computer malfunctions and things taken off the grid and flights had to be halted. And while that may or may not have to do with the lack of people, what does have to do with the lack of people is, now how do you get it back on? And as the prevalence of that continues, of these entire airlines just sort of going off the map as far as being able to control where they are, where they're going, what's happening in any one airport and causing all kinds of confusion and delays, that the people who are there to fix that would no longer be there to fix that. And I think that's a big point as well.
Yeah, and it should be highlighting our crumbling and outdated and already past expiration transportation infrastructure. And somebody's got to be talking about the fact that this administration canceled all of the infrastructure projects that had been launched in the previous administration. I mean, it's not like if Newark Airport is shut down, I can hop on my high-speed train and get to D.C. from Albany, because I cannot. And that, you know, would have been the alternative if we had passed an infrastructure reform bill 20 years ago when it was already past due.
You know, could we get an update from Sean Duffy about his effort to rebuild the air traffic control system and recruit new people so they can boost the staff there? I mean, we heard a lot about it after the Washington, D.C. crash, I think, but I haven't heard anything since. How about a status report?
Good luck recruiting federal employees now. Hey, we're not going to pay you for weeks at a time. We're going to treat you like, you know, crud, and it's going to be very stressful. Yeah, I think they're going to have a huge problem going forward. I saw United Airlines said it's not going to really affect their international flights. They're going to focus the pain on regional and domestic. Mm-hmm. So that's all of us and our families.
Mm-hmm. We're going to focus the pain on you. All right, we'll take a break. We'll finish up on the other side of that break. We welcome you. Last call for letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We've been talking about the 10% cut and within airlines at 40 airports and air traffic. And just I found this piece and I just wanted to go over some of these things because I thought some questions that we talked about are addressed. And obviously, we mentioned the airports that are being impacted or should be impacted. They are, officials are saying that this list is not finalized, but they put it out.
Sure,
anyway.
Looks blue to me.
Yeah, there you go. Should I change my flight? Airlines are saying that the vast majority of customers' travel will be unaffected. Keys expects the same and recommends travelers hold tight until they know that they have been impacted. I was referring to Scott Keys, the founder of the cheap flight service Going. I won't mention just the obvious, but if you're talking about 14,000 seats a day, that seems like it would be impactful, but there we go. How should I rebook a canceled flight? If your flight does get canceled, that's like a starting gun for a race. If you get yourself rebooked faster than the next person, then you win, and your trip is saved. If you're slower than the next person, unfortunately, your trip might be off altogether. You may be able to rebook yourself through the airline app or website if you need to get on the phone with an agent but are facing long wait times. They say to call the airline's international customer service centers instead of competing for time with the U.S. office. Try dialing the ones in Canada, Mexico, Spain, and Singapore, for example. FYI, you may incur charges for making international calls depending on your phone plan. Oh, this is great. Will I get a refund? And I just, as I'm reading this, I just keep on thinking of what Nick just said. In the United States, we can't keep our airports open. If the airline cancels or significantly delays your flight, meaning delayed more than 3 hours for a domestic trip or 6 hours for an international trip, you are owed a full refund if you choose not to travel. What are the airlines doing to help? Mm-hmm. Many of the major U.S. carriers are offering travelers more flexibility to cancel plans for a refund than usual. On its website, Delta Airlines said, "We are providing additional flexibility to all of our customers during the impacted travel period to change, cancel, or refund their flights, including our basic economy fares without penalty.
I was surprised that the airlines really are not speaking up in the way that I expected them to. You know what I'm saying? They're being very gracious in their comments. They're not really saying, like, this is a huge disaster and I blame both parties or whatever. I would have expected a lot more screaming and yelling by the airlines. And it's also going to affect cargo. This is not just a domestic, a passenger flight issue. This is going to affect cargo.
That's a great point. And again, holidays. So you are looking at the busiest time of the year in that realm as well, and to think of that being impacted, it's a huge deal, obviously. What about TSA checkpoints? Hours long security checkpoint lines over the weekend at Houston's Intercontinental Airport. Is it really an intercontinental airport? It's not international, it's intercontinental. Okay. You get breakfast. Made headlines, though wait times had dropped somewhat by midweek. Now there may technically be fewer flights and travelers, but don't expect shortened lines at the airport just because there's fewer flights. Obviously, as we get closer to Thanksgiving travel period, then all bets are off. Things will be tight no matter where you go. If the shutdown continues and there's a prolonged strain on TSA staffing, they may have you start to see much longer lines for security. TSA guidance recommends arriving at least 2 hours before domestic flights and 3 hours before international flights. So you could potentially wait for a 3-hour domestic flight on the tarmac and 6 hours on an international flight on the tarmac. So,
are TSA workers getting paid right now, or are they also working without pay?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're a part of Homeland. They're not. I don't think they're covered. So it's been weeks.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary Duffy have warned that Thanksgiving travel could be snarled if the shutdown continues into the busy holiday season. Vance said at a news conference, trying to ease the concern of flyers, "It will be a disaster," he said. Duffy used the same word, noting that air traffic controllers might need to take on second jobs to pay bills.
Yeah, I think the idea that lines would be shorter because there are less flights misses the whole point, which is there are not enough people working. So the lines will be longer even with the reduced flights because there are not enough people working. TSA is not getting paid right now either. Mm-hmm. Controllers are not getting paid. It's a public resource, right? So all the government workers that run the airports are not getting paid, but all of the private employees of the airlines are getting paid, and it is the airline corporations that are going to take the economic hit along with the individual workers at the airports.
But you wait longer in the TSA line, so you can get delayed. Anyway, we're out of time. My thanks to all of you. You're a great group. Wonderful to have you all here. March, a delight to have you back. Ashley, always a pleasure. Judy, Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
We will
thanks.
Continue in our next hour of programming. Stay tuned after these words.